A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, I'm Anoush.
And I'm Stephen.
And welcome to the New Statesman podcast. On this podcast, we discuss
Boris Johnson's tour of the Union,
our migration stories,
and you ask us,
could Boris Johnson lose his seat in Uxbridge?
You better not scream, you better not shout. Boris Johnson is coming to town on his tour of the Union. The Union.
The just about United Union.
Yeah, so he's visited Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. Predictably, of course, he had a fairly hostile reception from both the first ministers he met and actually on the streets of Edinburgh, which is kind of, we've got a slight disadvantage that we are doing this before the Brecon and Radnorshire by-election, for all of our listeners as well. But the slight wins is we kind of know, don't we, that whatever happens, Johnson will, the pact of Johnson, as it were, is they will become less popular in Scotland, and they hope that they will become more popular in Wales. Because it is in microcosm, you lose some Remainers, you hopefully get more than enough Leavers to make up for it.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's probably one of the calculations. I don't know how much you can read into the by-election result, considering Boris Johnson hasn't been Prime Minister for very long, but he is enjoying his honeymoon period. So however well or badly the Conservatives do, I think it's worth factoring in that he could drop a few points just from the fact that he's had a few points of a bounce simply by virtue of being a new Prime Minister in Downing Street. Theresa May also had a honeymoon period. So I think, you know, reading that result with a pinch of salt would be the best thing. This tour of the Union, it's been really interesting because while he's been talking up the prospects of no deal, he's now going to all of the places where no deal would be, you know, really unpopular and catastrophic. So how he's holding those two things together in these private meetings is a mystery.
So yeah, I was talking to a senior Conservative, and the way they put it, which I think is absolutely right, is the slight weirdness they said all of these visits are artificial in terms of the impression that we get from them, because most of the protesters have come up for the day. So that doesn't give you an idea of what the local reaction is.
Yeah.
But the excited selfies are because he's a famous person from the telly. It's not that every person who takes a selfie with Boris Johnson, when those people put it on Facebook, not all of them are going to put like, great to meet this man who's going to save the Union and save our country and get us out of the EU. Some of them will put, God, I can't believe I met that idiot off the TV. Look, there's a photo of me and the idiot off the TV.
Yeah, give me 45 likes on my Instagram.
Yeah.
Because it's funny. Yeah, I think that's really interesting. And also, even when you go to places where the Labour Party worries about Boris Johnson's star quality, you know, including places in London, including his own constituency, everyone knows his name. That's seen as a threat because, for example, the candidate running against him on his home turf, it does not have name recognition. But the fact that everyone knows his name does not translate into popularity. In fact, it can translate very easily into notoriety.
Yeah, I mean, I think whenever the polls look bad, you know, people in the Labour Party will kind of go, oh, well, look what we did last time.
Yeah.
One of the reasons why I am dubious that they can recreate those dynamics is last time most people didn't know very much about Jeremy Corbyn. They knew that Labour had a leader who had changed and was different before and who had been given a bit of a mullering in the press.
Mm.
But they did not have a particularly developed opinion of him. I think it's much harder to shift opinions about someone who has been in the public eye for a lot longer, who people feel they know.
Yeah.
And I think that is doubly true for Boris Johnson. I promise that I'm not going to become the, maybe have you considered electing Sajid Javid section of the podcast every week. But I think, to me at least, I look at polls showing that they have, you know, basically we've had polls from four pollsters now since the handover. The regular YouGov ones, Opinium, Comres, and Delta Poll. all basically showing Conservative Party getting back up above 30%, 31, 32, largely at the expense of the Brexit Party, losing some additional votes to the Liberal Democrats, and Labour basically staying where they are. But just as with Corbyn, people know who Boris Johnson is. I don't think that there is a chunk of people who are not saying they will vote for the Conservative Party now who won't. Now, of course, I do also, you know, the polls are polls, and I think they probably are better at telling us about change rather than levels. But yeah, I would kind of agree that I don't think that his public profile is that big of a deal. It's a big of an asset.
Yeah, and another problem that probably could be even more pressing for him is that his prime ministership, his premiership, has coincided with the pound falling due to the prospect of a no-deal Brexit. So how much could that that affect him in the sort of medium term or longer term? Because as people are buying their holiday money now, they're going to associate that money that they're losing with this new regime that we've suddenly got.
It's kind of a bit like the sort of what happens if there's a no deal Brexit. Mm. I don't think it necessarily people go, oh, this is because we're having a no deal Brexit, this is because of the change of government. I don't necessarily think for a lot of people that association is as direct as that. But it just does mean it's just like, oh, I'm feeling more poor as a result of my holiday than I was, or if I can't afford to take a holiday abroad once the fall in the value of the pound works its way through the economy and starts to be felt in shops, then I think it's quite striking, right? And at the last election, going into it, one of the things people said is no government has ever not lost seats if it's gone to the country where in real terms wages are falling. Mm. And because of what's happened to the pound, real terms wages are falling. But this government looks like it's not going to do that. And then lo and behold, I don't think it was the only reason, and maybe it wasn't a reason, but it would deeply worry me if I were in CCHQ or Downing Street, looking at a situation where whatever happens, you're probably going to have to go to the country fairly soon. Whether Parliament stops you doing Brexit, or simply because you do Brexit in a way Parliament doesn't like, or because you want to be able to keep any of your other promises on tax and spend. And my assumption, and I could be completely wrong, I'd be really interested to know what you think about this one, is just that if I feel poorer because my money goes less far, that makes it easier for the Labour Party to do the, there are a lot of opinions about Brexit out there, guys, but can't we all agree that we're feeling a bit broke and the public realm looks a bit rubbish? And I just feel it's easier to prosecute that argument if I am feeling a bit broke.
Yeah, I think you're right. There's a bigger vulnerability in terms of Labour's message getting through to people. It doesn't mean that people will necessarily think, you know, I don't have as much money for my weekly shop anymore. I'm definitely going to vote Jeremy Corbyn because it's all Boris Johnson's fault. They might not make that direct link like you were saying. But when the Labour candidate comes knocking on their door and saying, yeah, but, you know, don't you feel like you haven't had a pay rise for this amount of time? You know, don't you feel like you can't afford as much, you know, stuff for your kids, etc., etc.? That might chime with people more than it necessarily would if real terms wages were going up and they hadn't been stagnating for such a long time as well. The only way, I suppose, that the Conservatives will think that they can tackle that problem is with this thing that Boris Johnson is doing, where he's actually going to spend some money on public services, which we haven't had for nearly a decade of austerity. Again, I think that's probably more of a benefit to the Labour Party than the Conservative Party at this point, because whatever the Conservatives promise in terms of spending, the Labour Party are promising to spend more. So it's sort of, you know, for a shadow chancellor who's trying to make sure that all of their spending pledges are costed, that just gives them more leeway if the Conservatives are spending more of their budget on hospitals, for example.
I mean, I also think a lot of the things that they are doing are the things that I think would have made sense to do if Boris Johnson had won the 2016 Conservative leadership election. But, of course, he didn't. Mm. I essentially do sort of take the view that people trust, they see Labour as the party of public services. Labour tends to have a lead on whether or not it's more trusted to run those than the opposition, with the brief exception of when Paddy Ashdown sort of made the Liberal Democrats the party of education, and basically Labour led on every issue over the Tories and led on the Lib Dems on every other issue other than education, which Paddy Ashdown had successfully made his thing. But I think they can neutralise them if, when someone goes, our schools are in a terrible state, people go, that's not true. But it takes a while for public spending to be felt, right? Mm. Like, so Indra wrote that very good piece this week for us about the schools which are closing early on Fridays.
Yes.
Well, the gap between Sajid Javid standing up and going, I'm going to increase per pupil funding, and the letter going out going that school is now open for regular hours on Friday again is not instantaneous.
Exactly. And you can see that in the police officer recruitment as well. That's going to take at least 3 years. When are we expecting an election? You know, potentially before October.
I can see it working out two ways. Either you have an election where you go, we know there's these problems, but we've done a variety of things in the comprehensive spending review to fix them. And actually, wouldn't you prefer to talk about Brexit and national security? Possible. Equally, what happens is you have this situation where if you're a government minister, you have this sort of, you end up in the loser's corner on TV where you have to kind of go, but we have increased the amount by a record expense. And the presenter's going, but why is this local school still shut then? And you just look like a Marie Antoinette figure.
Yeah.
We can't know until an election is actually happening which one of those dynamics will play out, right? They're both plausible, but of course, one of them has quite a big downside consequence for the Conservative Party.
Yeah, exactly. And also, if they do want to talk about upping spending, then they have to own that. They have to accept that that's going to be part of their narrative going into a next election. And that's really difficult for them. For the example that you just gave, you know, none of this money is actually manifesting itself at the moment, and it takes a while to have an effect. But also, in terms of the Conservatives that don't want their party to be just spending money on public services that they don't think that their party can afford. You know, there are Conservatives who genuinely believe that austerity was the right path and you know, don't like the idea that just before an election you can start spending money on everything.
The fascinating thing is, from a, in terms of like the personal things that the people around this cabinet literally believe, this is a more economically liberal government than the one before it or the one that David Cameron led. In terms of the actual fiscal policies it is talking about doing, it is very much not in that place. Yeah, I think kind of in an odd way, the fear I would have in their shoes is that this government might end up like Zach Goldsmith, right? Now, Zach Goldsmith being appointed to be a minister at DEFRA and a minister of DFID is the kind of thing, in terms of the things he believes and says and has done and the positions he's advocated on those issues, is something which, if any other Conservative holding those positions had taken those jobs, you know, almost every NGO would be saying something, you know, not, you know, I'm not saying they'd be bringing out the ticker tape, but they'd be going, oh, that is a good, positive, you know, and we've got someone who cares about climate change and believes in the 0.7A target.
Yeah.
But because it's Zach Goldsmith, a lot of people, you know, both in their internal messaging and outside, basically gone, well, it's good that he agrees with us on that because of the halitosis of him being introduced to so many people as someone fighting a dog whistle or perhaps loud hailer campaign against Sadiq Khan. However, the group of people who absolutely do believe in Zach Goldsmith's position and credibility on those issues are farmers, who are opposed to what I would see as his very correct opinions on biodiversity, excessive use of glyphosate, etc. And the fear is, right, is the problem of Theresa May is that she ended up in this weird thing where she couldn't quite do well enough in taking, well, she fell significantly short of doing well enough in Labour seats to make up for the seats since she was losing over the other side of her coalition. The risk here is that if you just end up with, like, the policy agenda of Zach Goldsmith, but the people who like that policy agenda don't thank you because you're Zach Goldsmith / Boris Johnson / Dominic Raab. But you don't get all of the votes of the people who are aligned with those politics because you're not actually doing those politics.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So, Anoush, in this week's Summer Double, you have written about your trip to Ellis Island and seeing a familiar piece of graffiti. It's a very good piece, and I strongly urge people to read it. But yeah, tell us a bit about it.
Okay, well, at the end of last year, I went on a holiday to New York and it was sort of pouring with rain every single day. And you know when you're on a city break and all you do is walk around? If it's raining in that scenario, it can be really tiresome. So I very nearly didn't go to Ellis Island because it's you have to queue with loads of tourists wearing ponchos and you have to go on a ferry and it's really unpleasant. And on the ferry, there was this father on the ferry who was getting dive bombed by seagulls and all he was doing was trying to eat a hot dog. And it was just like, this is really depressing. Why are we doing it? But actually, it turns out that when we got there, and so for people who don't know, Ellis Island is where the immigrants would arrive to be processed before arriving in America. It was just really fantastic because we were walking around and they've kept some of the original graffiti of the migrants who were waiting for their applications to be processed. And the first piece of graffiti that I saw, I was like, oh, cool. You know, it's this old stone with a big plastic sort of protection thing over it. And I was like, I really recognise that writing. And it was a message in Armenian, which was just like the chances of that being one of the very few pieces of graffiti that survived. And it being in not only Armenian, but Western Armenian, which is an endangered language and happens to be the language that I grew up speaking as bilingual. The chances were so, you know, second to none. So it was just really, it was a great moment. So I researched this and it turns out to have been a message probably from a shoemaker who had travelled from the Armenian lands in what's now modern day Turkey, which is where my family originated from. And he'd written this message in Armenian. He'd drawn a little pomegranate tree, because pomegranate is the fruit of Armenia, and a little bird. And he'd just written this message saying about how fantastic it was that he could travel to the US. And it just sort of gave me chills, because it was my family migrated from Armenia, from those lands, to Lebanon. And then eventually my dad had to flee Lebanon during the Civil War he first made it to Cyprus on a boat carrying watermelons, and then he made it to the UK after that. And his siblings went to go and live in America. So I felt that it really chimed with my migration story, even though I was born in London.
Yeah, you've written a lot about, you know, the importance of the Armenian language to you and to Armenian. So it has 28 letters.
Yeah.
Two of which were added on later.
Yeah, I think 28 letters was the original, and then right. There were two added on later.
Right.
I think that's right. My Armenian teachers, if any of them are listening, will definitely tell me if I've got this wrong. So it came to its scholar in a dream, and he wrote down the letters. And actually, we always used to laugh in Armenian school because they told us this story, and that, you know, they're very reverent about the man who came up with the alphabet. But then actually they had to add two other letters on afterwards because the alphabet that came to him in a dream didn't cover all of the ridiculous sounds that you have to be able to make to speak Armenian. So the alphabet, it's a bit like, so you sing a song for the alphabet like you do with the ABC. So it's a bit like adding and YZ at the end, really awkwardly with no tune.
I mean, how do you think that being from a scattered diaspora that has, you know, faced multiple attempts to get rid of it has kind of, do you think it shapes your outlook today?
I think it does, yeah. So, you know, for those of you who don't know Armenia's history, it is one of persecution. So not only have they been in multiple empires like the Russian Empire, Soviet Union, Ottoman Empire, Iranian control, there was also a genocide during the First World War as well to try and wipe out the Armenian population. So it does make me very, very alert to the kind of modern anti-Semitism that we've seen a lot of recently, and makes me think, you know, that kind of complacency can lead to, you know, a certain race of people being demonized. So I look at a lot of the stuff that's happening, you know, in terms of not only anti-Semitism, but also the racism that Donald Trump has voiced, for example, like send her home, send her back. It makes me look at that stuff in quite a personal light, because although I'm not a migrant myself, you know, from being a second generation, you can see how easy it is for people to turn against you, particularly if you're sort of a stranger in a new land, like my Armenian family in Lebanon, you know. All of my dad and his siblings had to leave. So, I mean, not because they're Armenian, but because there was a civil war there. So, you know, the idea of upheaval being round the corner is something that I'm quite alert to. And, you know, any racism that can spark that should be sort of condemned full-throatedly.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. And I think the phrase in what I always think of is the thing that the novelist Linda Grant once wrote, which is, you know, being Jewish does teach you that there isn't always a happy ending.
Mm.
And I feel I do have kind of, you know, yeah, even though, you know, very few people in my family who are alive are observant in any meaningful sense. And obviously my mother in a very active sense is not Jewish anymore. But mm-hmm. I think that I do have that kind of slight sense of, I mean, paranoia or memory that is just like things can get really bad really quickly. I'm, you know, like I was born here. My mum was born here, but, you know, my grandmother did have to flee here heavily pregnant because of politics and political upheaval, which is why whenever kind of people go like, I'm sure it will be fine, or things always work out in the end, it's just like, it's also one of those things where it's just like, well, what is the end? Like, I mean, like, you could argue, you could say, well, apartheid worked out in the end, but, you know, it didn't work out in the end for the grandfather of mine who, like, died in his 50s because he had was a second class citizen, had British, like, yeah, like, I'm not remotely, you know, belittling the achievement of having multiracial, multi-party democracy in South Africa, but the end is a mover, you know, like, World War II worked out fine in the end, but, you know, there are an awful lot of spots in, you know, well, I realise we don't actually have a family Bible for obvious reasons, but there are an awful lot of, you know, and you don't really have a, it's not like there's a sort of back bit of the scroll, but, you know, there are an awful lot of bits of my family for whom the Second World War did not work out fine in the end.
Yeah.
And, you know, when people kind of, like, you see it a lot with the kind of, then even people who get it on Labour anti-Semitism, lots of them don't get it on conservative Islamophobia, because they kind of will basically kind of go like, well, this problem isn't as bad as this one. It's just like, well, actually, parking for a moment, the fact that I'm not wholly sold on that thesis. But even if you're not, it's like, well, that problem can become that problem.
Yeah.
And it's kind of where, like, oh, well, you know, so 60% of them have some Islamophobic attitudes. What do you expect?
Yeah, yeah.
What do you want us to do about it? And it's just like,
everything you can.
Yeah, that feels in that situation could get quite bad quite quickly.
Yeah, I really agree with you. That complacency, well, it was all right in the end. There's also a complacency like, don't be over the top. You know, yeah. We're not going to have a Holocaust here or whatever. So there was that interview that Margaret Hodge gave that yeah. everyone got so cross about, where she said that, you know, she was thinking of packing her bags. I think that's what yeah. she said. She said something like that. Or it reminded her of when her father used to say, make sure you have a bag packed. And you wrote a really moving piece about that, saying, there's nothing over the top about the mindset of sort of diaspora communities whose ancestors have been made to flee, thinking the worst.
Yeah.
There's absolutely no reason not to think the worst. I mean, this is the terrifying thing. You know, for my family living in Armenia before the genocide, they were living a normal life among yeah. people of different races and different religions. You know, there's a point where normal becomes not normal. And that's beyond the point of no return. So as soon as we have, you know, like significant groups of people who are Islamophobic or anti-Semitic, we've gone beyond the point of normality. It's no longer okay to be complacent.
Yeah. Now it's time for a section we like to call
You Ask Us.
Indeed. And this question is from Alan McGlennon. If a unified candidate is fielded in Uxbridge, what are the chances of them unseating Boris Johnson at the next general election? And what happens if the Conservatives can still cobble together a majority in that instance?
Great. A unified candidate, does that mean a Remain candidate?
I think it can mean anything.
Right.
I mean, I think one of the interesting questions is, what would this unified candidate in practice mean? Well, they would have to be a Remain. Yeah, I think one of the things which is quite important to remember whenever you start talking about unified candidates is, so I guess if I describe the, you've sort of been there, you've spoken yeah. to the candidate, if I basically kind of do the, like, well, look, here's what you would probably, the boxes you'd have to tick to get this, and then you can tell me whether or not you think this
yeah.
series of boxes would successfully.
Okay.
The Liberal Democrats and the Greens are genuinely democratic parties run at a local level, right? Which is why, yeah, one of the reasons why MPs don't defect to the Liberal Democrats is that it's not only is it hard to win your seat, it's impossible for the leadership of the Liberal Democrats to guarantee that your local party won't go, or we don't like them. Yeah, like Chuck Ramuna's defection in Streatham was facilitated by the willingness of the parliamentary candidate for the Liberal Democrats in Streatham to stand down in his favour, and of the local party to accept that.
Mm.
If either of them had gone, no, there's no button, and Vince Cable can press, or now Joe Swinson can press, to force them to do it. Similarly with the Greens, when the Liberal Democrats and Greens have cooperated on seat packs. Yeah, I remember a senior Liberal Democrat joking to me. They said, oh God, I thought I had to break off every 5 minutes to go and hold a vote somewhere before I could sign something off. But they were like, but they really do take it to another level. So, you know, for another candidate to get through, I'm just very aware I don't know anything like enough about the Uxbridge Liberal Democrats or the Uxbridge Greens, but they would certainly have to be a Remainer.
Yeah.
Labour are the second place party, so yeah, they would have to be a Labour candidate for the Labour Party not to be like, okay, yeah, sure, we'll stand down in favour of A and other. So what we really are in practice talking about is a Labour candidate on an explicit platform of remaining in the EU.
Yeah, enough of a Remain platform to for the Lib Dems and the Greens and whatever other smaller parties are around there to stand aside to campaign and support the Labour candidate.
Yeah.
So I do think that that tactic is not the kind of tactic that would work in a place like Uxbridge and South Ruislip. This is a outer London, northwest London, traditionally Tory suburb in a borough which voted narrowly but voted for Brexit, where it's now in sort of Tory Labour marginal territory. So Boris Johnson has 5,034 majority, I think. So that kind of political landscape is not one where you're going to get a huge groundswell of support off the back of campaigning for Remain. That is not the issue in that seat. And, you know, I'm sure that it would mean Labour could pick up a lot more votes from the sort of, there's a student population there because of Brunel University. So I'm sure that it would give Labour more of a chance. And it is, you know, the majority is quite slim, and there are people in the Labour Party who believe that they could win the seat, or at least they did a few months ago before Boris Johnson became Prime Minister, because the fear now is that, of course, the Conservative Party would put as many resources as they liked into that seat to make sure that their leader wasn't scalped, so to speak. So that there are people who think that they could win. So it could put them, you know, it could put Boris in a little bit more danger. But I don't think that that kind of strategy in a place like Uxbridge would work. Labour's biggest chance in that seat is running a campaign less about trying to unseat this right-wing, no-deal Brexiteer prime minister and more about the local issues, because the Conservatives have run that seat, you know, for decades. And some of the biggest problems in that seat are housing. South Hillingdon Hospital was one of the lowest ranked, I think, for its A&E. And there are some really big social issues there. So if Labour can run on those local issues, they probably got more of a chance of picking up votes than making it about Brexit.
Yeah, I also think, and I have much less, i.e. none, direct experience of walking around the constituency. And I think it's actually a problem in general with electoral packs, right? People kind of forget that actually they are almost always less than the sum of their parts. Mm. Because, you know, like, people do understand how first past the post works, right? So some of those people voting Green will come over, but some of them don't want to vote for the Labour Party.
Yeah.
Just as, like, you know, 20,000 people, however many it was, who voted Labour last time, you know, didn't slip and actually want to vote for the Greens, right? You kind of lose votes by... But also, my instinct is that if Johnson were to lose that seat, it would be if you ended up with a pattern of voter shifting a bit like the one we saw in Kensington.
Mm.
Labour vote went up, not by enough to have overhauled Victoria Borick's 2015 vote share. The problem that Borick had isn't she lost votes to the Liberal Democrats and to the Labour Party. And I don't believe, actually Kensington is a constituency I did go to at the last election, and I do have a better feel of why. I don't believe for a moment that the Conservatives who switched to the Liberal Democrats in 2017 in that seat would have done so to switch directly for the Labour Party.
Yeah.
Many of them wanted to send a message about that campaign. They were deeply unhappy about how it handled, and about the fact that some of them did feel that Victoria Borick had, yeah, one of them said to me that she had rubbed their faces in the fact that she was a Labour. And so some of them knew that by doing so they were increasing the chances of a Labour gain, but they weren't ever going to actively take the step of voting Labour themselves. And I think that's kind of the issue with direct pacts, that people kind of think like, oh, right, we've got these blocks and we can just move them around. It's just like, that's not quite how it works.
Yeah, I agree with that. And also, if you're someone in that seat like Uxbridge voting Lib Dem or Green, you're not a tactical voter, are you?
Yeah.
Because you're never going to get a Lib Dem or Green MP there. You're voting out of your principle and your enthusiasm for that particular party. So if there's a pact, who's to say that you'll then transfer your vote to the Labour candidate?
Yeah.
It's quite entitled to think that people will work in that way. Obviously, Boris Johnson, we've spoken about this before on the podcast, he is a galvanising force, or he could be, for his opponents. So maybe that, you know, maybe it would be an interesting test to see how far he can galvanise his opponents for voting for a party that they may not find particularly tasteful, but they know is the strongest opposition towards someone like him.
Yeah, and I think in terms of the follow-up of what would happen then if, you know, he's won, but he is not himself an MP anymore. I'm with the proviso that I just can't ever make the maths for it work. I can make the maths for Boris losing his seat work.
Mm.
I just can't really make it work for him to have lost his seat. But for, I just think at the point that they've lost Uxbridge, then it's like, well, good night, Mark Field. Good night, Justine Greening. Good night,
it's
Ben Bradley. You know, it's just like, at that point, it's like, well, they're not going to be in office anymore. So I just think it doesn't arise. What would happen in that situation? Well, I kind of guess it depends how well that the leader is judged to have done in the course of that campaign. If they are seen to have directly won it, then, you know, of course a by-election is found. If they are kind of seen to a bit of a liability, right? Like, let's say that the Liberal Democrats last time had somehow, despite the Tim Farron stuff, surged and got 100 seats, but Tim Farron himself had lost Westmoreland and... I don't think then there would have been this great clamour in the Liberal Democrat Party of actually the guy who, for all he's the architect of this policy, nearly ruined our campaign because of his inability to answer these questions about homosexuality and reproductive rights.
Yeah.
I just don't buy for a moment that they would have gone, oh, well, we must find some way back for Tim.
No, and I don't think, as you say, in this case, if Boris Johnson lost his seat in the general election, I don't think that he would be... I don't think the Conservatives would be in power, so I don't think that he would be someone who they were desperate to find a seat for in that scenario. Well, you know, one of the things that the Conservatives are worried about in that seat is the changing demographic. So there's more younger people moving there. There are a lot of seats like that where the demographic's changing. If the demographic has changed fast enough for Labour to win because of that, that means they're going to lose, like you say, a hell of a lot more seats where that change is slowly happening. So there's no way that they would be forming a government in that scenario, I don't think.
Yeah.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Anoush Shakelian, and my colleague, Stephen Bush. The New Statesman podcast is recorded by Emily Bootle and produced by Nick Hilton. And our music is Devil by the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.